You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2019 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother John Popel on the subject, Leading Ladies. This class is titled, Wings of Shelter, Ruth's Story.
Good morning again, everyone.
Good morning.
Did you all sleep well? Or at least enough? Very good. Excellent. So here we are once more. We're looking at our series of leading ladies, some of them offices in Scripture like the widow. But today, a very sort of literal interpretation and a very obvious and wise choice to look for leading ladies in the scriptural record, Ruth's story. And I've entitled this Wings of Shelter for reasons that I think will very, very soon become apparent. Let's jump in and have a look at Ruth's story. First of all, Ruth is an excellent representation of someone who is societally entirely disenfranchised, is coming from a position of weakness in a social status. For one thing, she's widowed. We know that. She lost her husband whilst in Moab, and that has much more social impact on her ability to even eat and find shelter than it might do today. However, yesterday, as I hope you'll appreciate, we maybe gained maybe a new insight into the position of a widow, the office of a widow in Scripture. Whilst in the material world it's a position of some considerable disadvantage, in the spiritual world we actually see it's an office of glory. It's actually an office that each and every one of us is called to be widowed to self in order that we might be married to Christ. So it is actually an ideal for which we all push and which none of us actually fully achieve. So it is a station of some glory as well as a position of societal disadvantage. She's a foreigner and an immigrant. Not only is she Moabitess, she's not a Moabitess living in Moab. She's a Moabitess who has come to the land of Israel as a foreign immigrant to settle, and that's going to be a disadvantage for her socially. And furthermore, it's not just any old country she's come from. Ammon and Moab were especially a shunned people from the Israelite assembly, as detailed in the law. So she's got just about every disadvantage one can have. And the crux of her meeting with Boaz is realized in this very unusual exchange here, this very unusually choreographed sequence. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man, and he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet. And so the obvious question is, what was Ruth doing? And why? And just to break down this choreographed sequence is going to reveal a certain number of jewels of great spiritual meaning and intelligence, that this has been a carefully planned sequence, which has rooted in the text itself. Let's therefore take a reading from that text that leads up and explains this interaction, and we'll see indeed that it was planned. Open your Bibles at the book of Ruth, if you will. And we're going to jump in at chapter 2 and verse 19. In fact, maybe for a variety of voice, is there a volunteer who'd like to read that for us? No, there isn't. Ben, there is. Excellent. Come forward, Ben, if you would. We're going to, starting at chapter 2 and verse 19, and we're going to read through to chapter 3 and verse 10, if you would, Ben. Thank you.
Ruth chapter 2, sorry, verse 19 to 3:10. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where have you gleaned today, and where did you work? Blessed be the one who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law, with whom she had worked, and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." Then Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "Blessed be he of the Lord who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead." And Naomi said to her, "This man is a relation of ours, one of our close relatives. Ruth the Moabitess said, "He also said to me, 'You shall stay close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, and that people do not meet you in any other field." So she stayed close by the young women of Boaz to glean until the end of barley harvest and wheat harvest, and she dwelt with her mother-in-law. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not our relative? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Therefore wash yourself and anoint yourself, put on your best garment, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be, when he lies down, that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go in, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do." And she said to her, "All that you say to me, I will do." So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law instructed her. And after Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. And she came softly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. Now it happened at midnight that the man was startled and turned himself. And there a woman was lying at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" So she answered, "I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative." Then he said, "Blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, in that you did not go after young men, whether poor or rich."
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Excellent. It's going to benefit us to understand some of the exact terms that are used here, because this is quite a detailed event. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. That's how she replies when he's startled and woke up. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." And what's four words there in this particular translation, four words in English that I've highlighted, "corner of your garment," is in fact just one word in the Hebrew. And it's the Hebrew word, and I won't try and pronounce it correctly. In fact, I'm going to deliberately mispronounce it to make it similar to an English word, which bears its root. It is the word canopy, right? It is speaking of a canopy. This robe has a canopy. It has the ability to cover over. And what's particularly interesting about this word in Hebrew is it's literally the same word that is used for a wing of a bird. So in Hebrew, a bird has two canopies. And when you say it that way, it kind of makes sense, because they're spreading out something that can clearly cover over. In English, we don't use that in describing birds. We do use that occasionally in describing trees or forests. We will say the forest has a canopy, and it's the same thing, the concept that the branches of the trees spread out and form a covering over a more shaded and sheltered area beneath. In fact, if we look at alternative translations, if you have the King James, you'll find, "I am Ruth, thine handmaid, spread therefore thy skirt." So skirt is the representation of the Hebrew canopy in this case. And I don't know what you were reading from there, Ben. Yes, and I think it's quite distinct, the New King James, and it does a really excellent job. So that was serendipitous. "I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing." Now, you might think that the English is taking something of a liberty with that kind of putting that idiom in place, but it really is not. It's actually very true to the literal Hebrew that this means wing. And so the idea of "take me under your wing" is true both idiomatically and literally in terms of what Ruth is saying. So this is a very good translation here in the New King James. Okay, so she's asking, "Take me under your wing. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." And in fact, God marries Israel this same way. What I mean is using this same language. Here I am, quoting from Ezekiel chapter 16, God is speaking to his nation Israel. "When I looked at you and I saw that you were old enough for love, I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the sovereign Lord, and you became mine." And so it's a language we're familiar with in the Bible to actually represent not only taking care of someone, but taking care of someone within a marital covenant. It's an engagement custom, at least in the language, the act of covering. Okay? And there's something quite attractive going on in the language as well. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. And we do know that this is something that Naomi had planned. So Naomi, with her faith rekindled by Ruth's acting in the role of Elijah, has actually recommended that she do this. Spread the corner of your garment over me, says Ruth, since you are a kinsman redeemer. Now, what isn't the slightest bit obvious in English is that this word here, uncovered, and this word here, kinsman redeemer, are very, very closely linked. In fact, they're direct opposites. In English, that doesn't make any sense at all to be linguistically attractive, but they are simply opposite words. An attractive symmetry is played out in the Hebrew text here. The Hebrew word for uncovered is galah, and it is the opposite of the Hebrew word ga'al, to cover. So she has uncovered him, and when he says sort of, what are you doing, or why are you here, I want you to cover over me. And so it's quite as simple, and Ben might even recognize someone here, but it's quite as simple as the childish game of peekaboo, is a cover to uncover, cover to uncover. It really is as simple and as attractive as that that's going on in the text. And we miss that because we're reading it in English and it isn't represented well in the English language. She uncovers him and then asks him to cover over essentially both of them, essentially himself and her with the canopy of his robe. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. Spread the corner of your garment over. What is she actually doing? And I think what she's actually doing and what Naomi and Ruth have planned together is to actually introduce the concept of empathy. Because as a widow, she is uncovered. She has no shelter. She has no source of income. Remember, she's gleaning, which is like one step above begging. She has no protection whatsoever. She is living in an unprotected sense. And so I think this is part of what what Naomi and Ruth have planned together, is that there's nothing indiscreet about what's going on. She's just saying, perhaps you'd like to experience life in an uncovered state. And fairly soon, whether or not anything startles him in the night, he's going to get cold, because that's what happens when you are uncovered. Ruth shows Boaz what it's like to be uncovered and without shelter. And I think we have this same responsibility. We who are living in this particular part of society, in this particular country, have about the most covered and sheltered and blessed lives we could possibly experience, have the same responsibility to empathize with those that don't. Not only just in a natural sense, but even the scripture seems to speak of this at a very fundamental level. The whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth, right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption as sons and the redemption of our bodies. So we are in a state waiting for redemption. We are in a state who are of being uncovered spiritually. And the writer here, Paul, is saying, actually realize the entire planet Earth is groaning, and realizes the whole creation is groaning as in the pains of childbirth, realizing that there is something fundamentally disastrous and uncovered about the state of this world now, and that it needs a covering. And we should feel that empathy in that condition. And again, as we remarked yesterday, we're living in a society at the moment which is entirely promoting the opposite reaction. The rejection of those in need, the rejection of immigrants coming to find shelter and such like. And yet we're being taught, if you really have the first fruits of the Spirit, that Spirit itself, that Spirit in you from God, is groaning at this pain that there are those who are uncovered. And in a way, the entire creation is uncovered and awaiting a redemption that it so desperately needs. Now, all of that gives a much deeper insight into the choreography and the word play and the meme play that is going on between Ruth and Boaz, that Ruth and Naomi have so carefully planned. But in actual fact, Ruth's introduction at Naomi's planning of the canopy of the robe is actually responding, I believe, to a comment that Boaz has made much earlier. Ruth and Naomi have been listening very carefully to what Boaz has been telling them, and 3 months earlier, he's made a comment to her, which they're now building from, I believe. Again, let's read about that, if we can, from Ruth chapter 2. And we'll see what happens at the barley harvest as Boaz arrives in Bethlehem. We're going to jump in at verse 4, and we're going to read to verse 12. I think I can manage this one. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they called back. Boaz asked the foreman of his harvesters, "Whose young woman is that?" He's seen Ruth, of course. The foreman replied, "She is the Moabitess who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.' She went into the field and has worked steadily from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter." So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with my servant girls. Watch the field where the men are harvesting, and follow along after the girls. I have told the men not to touch you. And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She exclaimed, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." And you'll recognize very clearly in that last clause, therefore, what Boaz has said and what Ruth, I believe, what Ruth and Naomi have very faithfully and very perceptively noticed, that Boaz had first, he was the first one to introduce this metaphor. And again, we're at tremendous disadvantage in English because we wouldn't know that this is exactly the same Hebrew word as the corner of the garment, as the skirt in the old King James version of the robe. That Boaz was the first person to say this. He says, "You have done well not only to look after your mother-in-law, but you have chosen to come and look for shelter under the wings of the Lord, the God of Israel." It's a beautiful metaphor. But I think Boaz, who is, I think, spiritually the equal of Ruth, which says a lot, is knowing that he's saying much more than that. In fact, I suggest to you that Boaz is referencing a specific pair of wings, not just using this as a generic idiom. What pair of wings do you suppose Boaz was referencing? Joan, did you say his own? That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. That's an interesting idea. You could well be right. And in fact, it'll turn out it'll match perfectly anyway. But any other ideas? The wing, absolutely, it comes from, well, the Shekinah is which I'm deliberately mispronouncing as the canopy, that's right. And so, well done, it's back from Moses' day, but even then you speak in general terms. These are physical wings, in a way. Where have we seen them? We've seen them on the Ark of the Covenant, I think. And then that's what Moses was referencing anyway, John, so you're quite right. I think, and see what you think of this, Joni, and I think you're right about Boaz. But what he's talking about, I believe, is these wings. And there's a reason why. First of all, these wings weren't just the artist's idea. They were commanded by God. God says to those designing the Ark, "You shall make two cherubim of gold at the two ends of the mercy seat. And the cherubim shall stretch out their wings above, covering the mercy seat with their wings." So there were actually two pairs of wings that stretched over. And what was therefore underneath the wings was literally the mercy seat, or the lid of the box, the mercy seat of God himself. It was, in fact, the focal point of God's mercy. And we can mean that God's mercy is worldwide. I like to think of it as kind of like a magnetic field. A magnetic field spreads across the globe, but if there is a source, that magnetic source still has a place where it acts more powerfully than others. The closer you get to the source, you realize the focal point of that power source, if you will. And so if we read about the Day of Atonement and whatever, we know that the actual central representative place, not the lid of the box, was magic in any way, but God had chosen to place his central presence there in terms of mercy underneath the wings of the cherubim spreading above. So I think Boaz knows this, and so he's saying, you've come to find mercy from the God of Israel. And so he says it in this very artistic way to say, you have come to sit here. You have sought refuge underneath the wings, which is the focal point of the mercy of Almighty God, of Yahweh, the God of Israel. And I think that's exactly what Boaz is referencing. And Naomi at least would understand that and be able to explain that to her. The Lord bless you, my daughter. And so these are the words that Boaz speaks after the little exchange on the threshing floor. So Ruth has now taken Boaz's wing and taken it away from covering himself, Boaz. So now Boaz is exposed as the widow, and he feels cold, and he feels disadvantaged, and he feels vulnerable, as does the widow. And then, who are you? I am your servant Ruth. Cover me over. I have uncovered you because you are a coverer. Or, as it says in clumsy English, a kinsman redeemer. You are a coverer. The Lord bless you, my daughter, Boaz replies to that statement. This kindness is greater than the one you showed earlier when you did not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. So Boaz is saying, you've done me two kindnesses, and the second kindness is even better than the first one. Now, the first kindness, as I read it, is that Ruth didn't just say, well, I'm young and healthy. I need a nice, young, healthy male to be my partner. She sees something in Boaz which is worthwhile, even though he may not be the same age or the same generation as her. The first kindness that Ruth showed to Boaz was not saying, you're too old for me, mate. I need a nice young man. And Boaz says, bless you for this that you've shown on the threshing floor. Bless you for this. This is a better kindness than the first one. Okay. So in what way has Ruth shown Boaz kindness? Because, I mean, seriously, if you come and uncover my feet during the night, you won't get anything like such a blessing, right? Oh, I'm cold now, stop it, right? But he said, no, that's wonderful. Particularly when she's replied, well, why don't you cover me? Because you are a coverer. Here's how I would paraphrase it to show the kindness. Boaz says to Ruth at the first harvest, you have come to take refuge under the wings of the God of Israel. That's my paraphrase. And then Ruth has said to Boaz on the threshing floor after she's uncovered him, well, actually, maybe I can find refuge beneath your wings. And so here's the point where I think we get to where Joni's point becomes extremely valid, right? If Boaz says to Ruth, you're looking for shelter under the wings of the God of Israel, and Ruth replies to Boaz, yeah, I think I can find that under your wings. What is Ruth saying to Boaz? The logistics is marry me. But she's saying something much more than that, right? Because... thank you. Say that again, Eric. She's saying, I see your God in you. Or you are God to me, yeah? She's saying, okay, yes, I did come to look for shelter under the wings of God of Israel, and I figure I can find that under your wings. There is an equation being made, you are God to me, or I prefer to say, I see the image of God in you. You are a good reflection. of your God. Your God has said, be made in my image. And Boaz, I think you've done a good job of that. I can see the God of Israel in you. And all of that is played out so subtly. And I love the subtlety, because the point is, if it turns out Boaz is not a godly man, boom, all of that's just going to go over his head. It's like, what? My feet are cold. Go away. Right? It'll be a self-filter. But because Boaz is as spiritually astute as Ruth is, they can have this back and forth conversation, which is incredibly encoded. But they both understand the code of the God of Israel. And so they can speak to each other as if they were speaking plainly. And that's a beautiful filter. It's so powerful. I really enjoy that. And that, I think, is the greater kindness, the second kindness. Firstly, she doesn't go after the younger men, but secondly, she says to Boaz, I see the God of Israel well reflected in you. And Boaz says, bless you, my daughter. That is a far greater kindness that you have done me. So this is not just a romantic story. This is a romantic story between two, you know, spiritual heavyweights who are able to well understand the code that God has explained himself in. But as Pam said, there are tangible results to this. This isn't just an ascetic, esoteric conversation. And the tangible results are that Boaz will marry Ruth in reality and provide a home and shelter and food for her and, of course, Naomi both. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Boaz says, Mahlon's widow as my wife. In order to maintain the name of the dead, that's Mahlon, with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from the town records. Today you are witnesses. So Boaz is going to take on the needs of Ruth and of Naomi, and also whatever costs are associated in restoring Mahlon, who has died without children, and providing, presumably from their first son, an inheritance and a line for Mahlon. So Boaz not only protects Ruth, he, as much as a human ever can, resurrects Mahlon, or at least by restoring his genealogical line. Let's see how important it is what Boaz has done for Mahlon, because this is, so providing shelter has tangible results, and it will if we provide shelter for others. I've also acquired Ruth as my wife so that Mahlon's name won't disappear from among his family. This is to be Christ. To resurrect your dead brother, you couldn't be more like Christ. Jesus called out in a loud voice, Lazarus, you who are dead, come alive, come out. Jesus raises his dead brother. This is good news for Lazarus then, and perhaps more relevantly, or slightly more selfishly, wonderful news for us now. This is Jesus' job. I am the resurrection and the life. He that believes in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. Lazarus, come out. I resurrect dead brothers. It's what I do. It's my job as Christ. And Boaz says, yep, I do the same thing as best as my limited abilities will allow. This is Christ. And therefore it shows us who then is Antichrist. Antichrist is the one who won't resurrect his dead brother. And we saw him, or we talked about him very briefly yesterday. Onan. Onan knew that if he had a child with Tamar, that child, that first child, wouldn't be his. And he would lose the inheritance of Ur that he'd otherwise taken and have to give it back and resurrect his dead brother Ur. So whenever he lay with Tamar, his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to make sure that he didn't produce offspring for his brother. And what he did in doing that was wicked in the Lord's sight. So he put him to death also. And it's a disaster that these words, that humans are so often distracted by sexual mechanics, that there are entire denominations of Christianity who forbid contraception. And these are the verses they quote. Why? And they call it Onanism. They say, well, see, Onan developed a form of contraception, and God killed him for that. But he wasn't killed because he developed some manner of contraception. He was killed because he was Antichrist, because he refused to bring life to his dead brother. And the spiritual lesson is ignored, and the sexual mechanics are over-focused upon, and you end up with a disastrous situation. in interpreting the message that God is trying to sell us. Onan was a disaster either which way. The good news is Boaz knew the work of Christ before even Christ came and was willing and desired to bring his dead brother. In fact, it wasn't even his brother, was it? It was Ruth's former husband, Mahlon, who didn't know from a bar of soap, back to life because he had the ability to do so. Wonderful stuff. And so break here just to have a little look at the structure of the book of Ruth as a literary piece, because there is spiritual value in this. I'm not interested in literary analysis for its own sake. There's 10 people. You almost certainly won't know a single one of them. But if I were to say to you that two of those people are more important than the other 8, you know which two it is, and you don't know them, at least on this day. And how do you know that? And the answer is because you understand how a chiasm works. You may have never heard the word before. That doesn't matter. You know how it works. And that's why you know which two of those people are the most important on this particular day. And that's what a chiasm is. It's a very beautiful structure which can subtly tell you a clear message. This is the most important area right here. Without you even ever having to sort of, you know, without people having to wear labels around their neck saying, look at me, I'm important, or look at him, he's more important, which is ugly and crass. And so what it's done is a structure designed as a sequence of anti-symmetries. So on the left, you have here 4 females, and on the right, you have here 4 males. And in this sense, the male is the antithesis of the female. You don't have 4 females on both sides. It's females on the one side and males on the other. And furthermore, the chiasm is strengthened by a dress code. Each of these 4 females on the left is dressed as much as possible identically, so they are homogenized. Each of the males on the right is dressed identically and homogenized, so that the male and female in the center, who are slightly are differentiated by dress, are further accentuated. And there's a possibility, I mean, doubtless the best man has been chosen because of a personal relationship, and likewise the maid of honor, but the others may have even been arranged by height, this often happens, in order, again, by having antithetical components on the left and antithetical components on the right, you emphasize what is in the middle, and you show that the two most important people in this photograph, which you knew the instant you saw it, were the two in the middle. And that's how chiasm works. So we can do it in a photograph, you can do it in a choreographical arrangement, you can also do it in literature. And literature lends itself to even more possibilities. And so what's accentuated here is that the groom here has a different dress code, only slightly different. The cut of the jacket is fractionally different, and there's a white bow tie and not a blue sort of Windsor knotted tie. But the bride's dress code is strikingly different from all of her bridesmaids. And that even suggests if there's a greater difference here than there is here, why then in actual fact there is one person in the photograph who is more important than all the others on that particular day, and you know which one it is. And everyone at the wedding knows that the most important person on this particular day is the bride. When I say everyone at the wedding knows that, everyone at the wedding, with the curious exception of the bride's mother. But that is a true mystery, too deep for me to understand, and we shall have to let it be. That being the case, therefore, this is how literary structures can also be composed, and the Book of Ruth is composed very beautifully in this way. Let me just leave it to a few details. It starts off with Naomi fleeing Israel because there's no food to eat for Moab, which is a disastrous thing. And then we have a situation where Naomi's husband dies and the children's husbands, they die too. Famine and mourning in those opening verses. Ruth herself is personally bereaved of her husband, and I wouldn't speak lightly there. I would have no idea how much pain that would be to lose one spousal partner. Immense, I'm sure. And then in a curiously poor piece of judgment, Naomi, who tragically has lost her faith, or at least is struggling greatly with her faith, actually tells Ruth, don't come with me. There's nothing for you in Israel, apart from the God of Israel. Go back to Moab. Live your life in Moab. You're best off there. And then you have this wonderful pronouncement at what I think is the spiritual center of the book, where Ruth makes the open declaration, amongst other things, that she says, your God will be my God. I make conscious choice to connect with the God of Israel. That is going to be my God. And on that fulcrum, everything flips around. Ruth says, in contrary to Naomi's advice, I am coming to the house of bread. I am coming to Bethlehem. I am coming to Israel to find refuge, as Boaz would phrase it, under the wings of the sheltering God of Israel. And then, consequently, after this beautiful interplay, this romantic and spiritually intense interplay that we've seen between Ruth and Boaz, she gains a husband. And there are scenes of joy and plenty for Ruth and for Naomi and for Boaz. And finally, in the final verse of the book, the king of Jerusalem is born, or at least he's mentioned that this will be the birth of King David. Notice, therefore, amongst these sort of bridesmaids and groomsmen, if you like, to make sort of some comparison, you even have the opportunity not just to homogenize them, these are not homogenized events at all, but you make these very attractive couplets. You see, look, these two here are opposites. Naomi says to Ruth, go away from Israel, go to Moab. And Ruth in Moab says, no, I choose to come to Israel. These are opposites. Ruth loses a husband. Ruth gains a husband. Fairly obviously, they're opposites. There are scenes of famine and mourning. And yet amongst the harvests and the celebration of the new marriage and the birth, there are scenes of joy and plenty. So these are opposites. And of course, the citizens of Israel need to flee Israel. Well, Israel not only is populated, but the very throne of Jerusalem obtains the godliest king it has yet seen to date. So you have these beautiful antithetical couplets that act as the chiasmic structure to say, here's the most important bit. Don't just look for a punchline in the last line of the book. This book is written as a chiasm. And if you want to know where the center of material is, the most important thing that happens, then you look right to the center here, right to the center here. And it is the point about which everything turns. You have this entire axis of tragedy. Everything that happens here is terrible in different ways, flipping around to an axis of glory, that everything that happens here is a glorious thing. And that's how the structure of Ruth is written. And it's beautiful to see it in that way. Remember that, because we're going to need that later. Time passes. Boaz is the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth, of course. Obed was the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of King David, as recorded in the Gospels. So now then, we come to the time of King David. So Ruth is David's great-grandmother. I think that's correct. Great-grandmother. And given the reproductive sequences, or the sort of spacing of a generation, if you will, being much tighter then than it is now, now children are delayed largely for socioeconomic reasons, then we can know that Ruth and David, the chances that they met, the chances they knew each other, are frankly very high. So it's almost certain David is bouncing on Ruth's knee. And given that Ruth and Boaz's story is so attractive as a family story, as a romantic story, and most importantly of all, as the revelation of two spiritual titans discovering each other, is it any surprise that David frequently quotes from that beautiful phrase that characterizes Ruth and Boaz's meeting? Keep me as the apple of your eye, David writes. Hide me in the shadow of your wings. Where do you think he got that phrase from? This is his great-grandmother's story. And he's quoting it there. Do you know he's the only psalmist who does? You might think, oh, the shadow of your wings is somewhere is in the Bible. Yes, it is in the Bible. And it's David, 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 and David again who uses it. How priceless is your unfailing love. Both high and low among men, find refuge in the shadow of your wings. Psalm 36. And again, I long to dwell in your tent forever and take refuge in the shelter of your wings. In all, in fact, there are seven psalms of David. David loves this personal family metaphor. He uses it in no fewer than seven of the psalms we can discover How well then indeed has Ruth imprinted that upon David? I'm going to attribute that to her education. These commandments that I give you today, says God via Moses, are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children and your great-grandchildren. And Ruth has done an excellent job, I think, in seeing that David is so taken with this beautiful metaphor that describes the sheltering acts of the father. This also helps explain a few verses that they're not the most important verses in the Bible, but they're very mysterious, and the mystery completely evaporates now that we understand this. David is fleeing from Saul, and he's hiding in the caves in the desert. I forget the name of the place. Have mercy on me, O God. He's writing this psalm as he flees from Saul. Have mercy on me, O God. Have mercy on me, for in you my soul takes refuge. I will take refuge in the shadow of your wings until the disaster has passed. He's penning this psalm somewhere during his flight from Saul's psychotic and psychopathic pursuit to destroy and execute David. And at one point he's hiding in the back of the cave, you remember this, and Saul comes in to relieve himself in some manner, whether sleep or some other manner, and David realizes he has an advantage over Saul. And if he can prove to Saul, look, I was close enough to kill you, but I didn't kill you. Will you please leave me alone? And this is the plan that's enacted. David crept up unnoticed and cut off the canopy of Saul's robe. Afterward, David was conscience-stricken. I prefer the old-fashioned, cut to the heart. David was cut to the heart for having cut off the canopy of Saul's robe. You see, without knowing the story of Boaz and Ruth, that's a very bizarre thing, isn't it? I mean, why would he be so badly struck? Why would he be so badly emotionally impacted of what he'd done? He'd done a very sensible thing. He was able to show, hey, look, I was right next to you with a sword, and I let you live. Now, will you please stop? That's sensible. And later he'll take a spear and a water jug. But in this case, he slices off the canopy of Saul's robe. And I'm sure he shortly thereafter was thinking, this is the canopy. This is the symbol of someone's ability to give mercy. And that is the King of Israel. It's not that the robe, oh, I have such, you know, reverence for the material. Who cares? It's a piece of cloth. But this particular part of the cloth was the symbol of Saul's ability to cover Israel. For Saul's ability, whether he used it or not, to bring shelter to the people he was supposed to serve. And David had sliced it off him. David amputated Saul's wings, the very symbol of Saul's ability to reflect God in giving shelter, as Boaz, his great-grandfather, once had done. And I think it's that David realized. This is my favorite family metaphor, and I've just wrecked it. And I think that's why he's conscience-stricken, because of what he's done. So understanding these patterns helps us to realize what it is that cuts David to the heart. Perhaps there's one more, even more beautiful use. And I said, you know, the idea, the metaphor of the wings of shelter of the bird is used by David and only David throughout the Bible. There is, of course, one exception. Who else used that metaphor? The son of David. Correct. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who killed the prophets and stoned those who sent to you. How often have I longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. The son of David knew this metaphor too. Where did Jesus learn it from? I think Jesus learned it from his appreciation of David's work and of Ruth and Boaz's interaction. Sometimes we tend to make Jesus a little bit too magic, as if all the things of God naturally occurred in his heart. I think he knew his scriptures and he communed with the Father, and both mechanisms taught him the wonderful things that he knew. Sheltering under the wings of the Lord. So there's a wonderful opportunity to see another quite mysterious verse and make sense of it in a way that I've never made sense of it before. Remember the soldiers gambling for his clothes? But there was one piece of clothing which was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. Let's not tear it, they said to one another. Let's decide by lot who will get it. Who cares? You think Jesus cared? They're going to crucify him. If you're going to crucify me, I don't really care what you do with my shirt. but is not a prime concern. And yet for some reason, God has decided we need to know about this little bit. We need to know that that one piece that Jesus had was never amputated, was never ripped up, was never cut up like Saul's robe once had been wrongly by King David. Jesus' wings were never amputated, even in death. That's true of the garment. What does that mean if you spiritually translate that? His ability to give shelter was not constricted by his death. In fact, isn't the reverse true? It is not just that his ability to grant shelter wasn't constricted by his death. His death actually provides a greater covering even than when he was alive, because his death prompts his resurrection, his immortality, and his enlarged powers to bring covering. And I think that is why that garment wasn't torn up. I can't make sense of this verse. Not that I care. I mean, no one loses sleep at night over this verse, do they? But it's nice to see little mysteries just melt away when we see some of the bigger patterns with which God works. There's a lovely one here too. As an eagle stirs up its nest and hovers over its young, spreading out its wings so that its wings give shelter to the chicks beneath, taking them up and carrying them on its wings, so the Lord alone was the one who led Israel in this way. I'm going to focus here on this little verb, hovers. It's rather nice. It's the verb that describes God's desire to shelter his young, to cover them over with his wings. And it's a rare word in the Bible. It's once in Jeremiah, it's once here, and it's once, the third and final time, once somewhere else. Do you know where that somewhere else is? At the very beginning of the description of creation, the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. The King James doesn't do a good job here. What I like here is the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters, which gives you the picture as early as the second verse of the Bible that God says, you realize who I am, don't you? I have made all this and I have spread my wings. I hover above it all. My Spirit has hovered over this earth from the time that it was formless and empty. How much more do my wings hover there now, if only you can perceive them? It's a wonderful extension of the Spirit of the wings of shelter that we see so emulated, well emulated in the life of Ruth. There's one more verse. This is our closing slide. There is one more verse to which we can attribute a deeper understanding, I believe, via what we've learned from Ruth, from our leading lady from today. This is the favorite verse for a lot of people, and rightly so. I can understand why. Youths can go, even youths who have so much energy, wasted on them, isn't it, really, grow tired and weary. And young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles, run and not grow weary, walk and not be faint. And the metaphor, therefore, that we see here, it's beautiful words in whatever it means and whatever it might mean, is as a bird, you can only fly if you spread your wings. If you wish to go into the heavens, you can only do that if you fly. So we ascend to heaven, these verses imply. You know what I mean and what I don't mean. We ascend to heaven, i.e. learn to fly, by spreading our wings. That is mechanically correct and obvious for a given bird, eagle or otherwise. You ascend to heaven, learn to fly by spreading your wings. Can we translate that? Translation. We ascend to heaven, we grow closer to God, not just in some geographical sense, for God is everywhere, i.e. we learn to fly, i.e. we develop God's character. We ascend to heaven, grow closer to God, develop his character, by what? By our provision of mercy. You want to be more like God? Show more mercy. Because the more mercy you show, the further your wings spread. The further your wings spread, the higher you can fly. The higher you can fly, the closer you are to God. It's mainly just a metaphor and an idiom, but it's true in the actual spiritual sense. Not that God is at some prescribed altitude, obviously, but there is a spiritual reality by which that is true. enact mercy, we grow closer to God. Thank you very much for your attention.